This is KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. Early this morning, U.S. Senate Democrats ended a 15-hour filibuster. They took over the Senate floor yesterday to try to force action on gun control. In the wake of the Orlando massacre, Democrats want action on bills that would mandate expanded universal background checks and bar suspected terrorists from buying guns. Washington Senator Patty Murray spoke during that filibuster. She told me why she thought it was so important.
I am just overwhelmed by the feeling that we keep having these kinds of incidents, just as we did in Orlando, and we all come out and our thoughts and prayers go to those who have been hit by this, harmed by this, felt by this, and that's absolutely appropriate, and it ends. And I think many of us feel strongly that we have to do more than that, and now is the time. We just can't stop. We can't be feel defeated. We need to act, and we need to show that Democrats mean it when we say we're going to not continue business as usual. We have to act to address the scourge of gun violence.
The filibuster resulted in Republicans agreeing to hold a vote on two issues. One of them is expanding the background checks you have to go through to buy a gun, expanding those beyond gun stores to internet sales and public gun shows. And we've already done that here in Washington State. So what do you tell other senators about Washington's experience with expanded background checks?
It is working in Washington. It should be done nationwide. As we work to make sure that those who should not have guns for reasons such as their being a terrorist, they are on a terrorist watch list, and we don't want them to have access to guns. The only way to make that really happen is to assure that if you purchase a gun at a gun show or on the internet, that you too have a background check.
You brought up the other thing Republicans agreed to vote on, which is banning people on terrorist watch lists from buying guns. The problem with that, Senator, is a little thing called due process. The Orlando shooter was removed from a terrorist watch list for lack of evidence that he was about to commit a crime. Isn't due process a civil right?
Absolutely. Everybody has a right to due process, and we all feel strongly about that. But we have crafted this legislation so that individuals who are known or suspected terrorists, if they are on the no-fly list, they will be stopped from purchasing a gun or explosive. They then have the right to go back and get themselves off the list if they should not have been on it. But at least that puts a pause in it so that someone who is on the no-fly list or a suspected terrorist cannot purchase a gun and have what has happened now one too many times.
You know, Senator, what gun control advocates are used to from Congress, as you've said, is nothing. A lot of death, and then a lot of talk, and then a lot of nothing. Senator Murray, why should your supporters believe that anything is new this time?
Well, look, I'm hopeful that Republicans will finally listen to the overwhelming number of Americans who want to keep guns out of the hands of terrorists and implement universal background checks. If they don't do the right thing, we are not going to give up. This is such an important issue for our families in our state and for people around the country. And if these common sense measures don't pass, it's just a prime example of how out of touch the GOP is with everyday people. I have had a tremendous response back from people who are saying, we no longer want talk, we want action. Our state has done this. It's time for our country to do this.
You're right that these proposals might not pass. If this is voted down, Senator, then what?
Everybody is going to be watching these votes, and all of us will have to be responsible for the decisions we make. We're going to keep up the pressure on this. If we do not win this time, we're going to keep on working. I believe the American public wants us to stand up and do everything we can to protect our American citizens here. These are two critical steps, and we're going to keep working.
Those ideas sound popular in Western Washington. What have your Eastern Washington constituents told you about that?
Well, look, I have to tell you that I believe most Americans, wherever they live, do not want people who are on the terrorist watch list to be able to purchase automatic weapons. It is pretty common sense, and I think it is overwhelmingly supported.
Your opponent, Republican Chris Vance, denounced the filibuster. He says, well, you shut down the U.S. Senate, stopped work on an appropriations bill, and when we talk about gridlock in Congress, he said, Senator, that you're part of the problem.
Look, I respond to what we need to do to get things done in this country. And if the only way we can get the Republican majority, who is in charge of this Congress today and in charge of the Senate, to wake up and realize we mean it, is to talk all night long. That's what we do. That's what we did last night. It made a difference. They finally agreed to allow votes on these amendments. That is all we were asking, is just allow us to vote. And now we're going to be allowed to vote on them. And the American people want us to do our job. That's what we're doing.
That is U.S. Senator Patty Murray. Republicans have agreed to vote on two measures that would expand gun control. You're listening to The Record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Asher Rowan lost a friend at Pulse Nightclub in Orlando on Sunday. Asher was at work in Ballard when he found that out. Since then, Asher has felt pain, sadness, horror. He's also felt anger, and he wants to do something with that anger. He wants to take action. So he is organizing a march this Saturday, not a parade, but a march through the streets of Seattle.
You know, what are we fighting against? We're fighting against fear, and we're fighting against hate. And giving hope to those who don't have hope right now is what we're fighting for, to let them know that you can come out of your house. If you're a young person and you're afraid to be openly queer in public, we're going to be openly queer for you, all of us together. We're going to stand and march down the streets. It'll be peaceful. There's no need to riot. There's no need to harm anything. But to quote Harvey Milk, hope will never be silent. And this is an opportunity for us to be loud.
What is the difference between a march and a parade in this case?
Well, in this case specifically, I think because pride is about love and joy and acceptance and openness, the serious tone of a march is what I'm after here, as opposed to the sort of light, carefree tone of the parade.
And why is that?
Because this is serious, because this isn't to be taken lightly, because you take 50 of us down and 500 of us will replace you. This is not a time for, you know, taking our shirts off and riding motorcycles down the street. This is the time for signs and flags and voices united. Pride is universal, but it's not a part of Pride Fest.
Yeah.
This is for Orlando, and this is for the civil rights movement, and this is for queer people all over the world who don't have a voice.
How would you characterize the emotion behind the march you're imagining?
I don't like to use the word anger, but I am angry. But the tone behind it needs to be a positive tone. There can be some positive in a fight, you know. There can be voices united that are heard and can instill hope and be strong and still do it in a peaceful way, I guess.
Why don't you like to use the word angry here?
Because there's a connotation that with fighting and anger that it almost, is that hate? Is that hateful? Is that instilling fear? Is that doing what we're trying to fight against? So I'm trying to find a more eloquent way of saying the same thing, basically, you know. If that makes sense.
Doesn't anger have a righteous history when it comes to civil rights?
Absolutely. So maybe I shouldn't be so afraid of saying angry.
Envision this march for me that you're thinking about. What do you want? Who's there? What does it look like? What's happening?
I would like it to be more than just queer community. Anybody who feels oppression, anybody who feels fear and hate toward them or has in their past. I'd like more people to show up than just the queer community, but if it is just us, that's okay as well. I want to see a younger crowd as well. I think the generation right below mine, more so than mine even, is growing up in a time where they're going to prom together. It's so accepted that I kind of want them to remember that the fight isn't over yet. There are a lot of gains to be made. And to kind of remember queer history and culture and where it's come from and where we're at now. So I'd love to see a youthful crowd show up. I'd love to see college kids in early 20s, teens. I don't know if you can get permission to go out and do that sort of thing, but I'd love to see the younger generation join the battle. We're so fortunate in Seattle specifically to live in this place of, it's so progressive, and it's really easy to be free and open here and not even feel what I felt as a small child from the Midwest in a small town that so many people, especially kids across the country, do not have. So we have the opportunity to not just take it for granted, but actually stand up and maybe it can get some exposure and maybe someone somewhere can be like, you know what? I don't have to be held down by this fear. I can leave my house and I can join with others like me and know that it's okay. It's okay to be different. And this isn't just about queer culture. This is a civil rights movement. This is about all people who feel oppressed and who are torn down by fear and killed for being who they are.
How have you seen a demonstration like that make a difference?
I mean, I haven't in my lifetime personally, you know. I always harken back to those Harvey Milk days where it made a huge difference. It made a huge difference. If people just sit back and do nothing and say nothing or talk about it behind closed doors, then what's going to really happen? But if you all show up in the streets and say, no, we are here, we are to be heard, you will listen to us, then something has to happen. It has to. Fear and hate do not win. The opposite of war isn't peace, it's creation. I want to create a movement, create a march where we actually, you know, create some hope as opposed to feeding into the fear. That was a Rent quote, by the way.
If that's happening on Capitol Hill, the Pike Pine Corridor in Seattle, Washington,
who's going to care?
Aren't you marching to the choir? Whose mind gets changed?
That's what I'm saying. Maybe it's just one kid somewhere else that hears about it or sees it. You know what I mean? So, yeah, so that's giving up before we start kind of thing. I don't believe in that. That doesn't, you have to keep going. Just because we won here doesn't mean the battle's over and doesn't mean everyone else doesn't still need. I think I was asked earlier, you know, if I could, you know, say something to the people in Orlando, what would I say? And I would say, we're here with you still. They're mourning still, and we are here. We're supporting you. This is us supporting you. This is different than pride. It's different than a parade. This is us standing together and showing our support for these people in a land where we have it all made. When it's, well, gay marriage is, and marijuana is all legal, and we can have our happy, perfect little city that doesn't exist everywhere else. And so just because we have it made already doesn't mean we have to stop fighting for the rest of the group that doesn't have it made.
And it's different from a candlelight vigil.
Absolutely. That is a time. That was a mourning. That was a memorial. That was a service, you know. It was sad, and it was a time to hold hands and hug and light candles for the fallen. And this is a chance to stand up for the people who are still here, who are still fighting, who are still being persecuted. And that's our job as the survivors.
Asher, this is personal for you. You lost a friend in that Orlando shooting. How do you think that's affected you?
You know, it's closer to home, I guess, you know, for me personally. I didn't know for most of the day that I had lost someone. I lived in Orlando a decade ago, and so I, of course, knew people there, but I guess it definitely took a greater toll on me personally because it is personal.
Do you mind telling me how who your friend is?
We worked in entertainment together.
Uh-huh.
In the theme park capital of the world.
Sure.
Early 20s.
Yeah.
Very talented, handsome young man, singer. His name's Shane. He's wonderful.
What would you like to say to your friends of victims, families of victims, survivors? What do you want to say?
I'm sorry that you have to deal with it. I'm sorry that you guys have to be there on ground zero. And again, we live in a really awesome place, and I'm sorry that I'm sorry it happened. It's the most tragic thing to be have your life taken for who you are, so for being something you can't change. I want them to know that their brothers and sisters are still fighting with them. Even though we're not there in person, we are still here.
That's Asher Rowan. He's organizing a march in response to that Orlando shooting, and he's asking you to come to Cal Anderson Park on Capitol Hill at 11 o'clock Saturday night. That's 2 a.m. in Orlando when the shooting happened. 1 week after the attack. We're tweeting out a link with more information on that march. We are at KUOW. Thank you for being here with KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. A few months back, we introduced you to the Alhamdan family. They're Syrian refugees, among the first to arrive in Seattle since war broke out in their home country. KUOW's race and culture reporter Liz Jones wanted to know how the family is adjusting to life in America so far.
Every afternoon, Bassam Alhamdan's watch beeps at 3:10. The school bus will arrive in 20 minutes.
It's time to go? Okay.
An interpreter walks with us to the bus stop. It's just around the corner from their apartment in West Seattle.
I usually come here early before the bus, way ahead of time, because I want to make sure that I can receive my children and I have no fear of missing my kids.
Hello.
Other parents start to gather.
Hello. Have you guys met Bassam?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Bassam is a father of six. His three youngest charge off the bus. They laugh and hug him. Five-year-old Ahmed gets a piggyback ride home. On the way, I ask about school.
Have you made some new friends?
Wahed? I have one friend.
Oh, what's his name?
Shuismo.
Lincoln.
Lincoln.
At home, the kids toss off backpacks and eat a snack. This is their routine now, since they moved here in November. But in the last few years, they missed a lot of school. First in Syria, as the civil war intensified, then at a crowded, chaotic refugee camp in Jordan, where they fled to in 2013.
First of all, the place is a desert, and we lived in tents. So the water is not clean, and it's not a healthy place to live.
Now the family lives in a four-bedroom apartment.
Family big. Family, big family.
That's Bassam's wife, Raba. A local Muslim group helps cover their rent for now, but they'll both need to find work soon. They're taking English classes to get ready.
Of course, the English language is the key to life.
3 months school.
Oh yeah, 3 months school you've been. This is the boys' room.
Their oldest son, Mohanad, is camped out in his room, texting on his phone. Bassam was relieved to get him out of Syria.
His son was in the age of military, so they could take him any moment, any time.
They saw bombings, and food became scarce, so they left the village where Bassam and Raba grew up, where they had a large home with fruit trees and where most of their relatives still live.
I didn't want to leave my country of birth, all of my memories, for the sake of my children. And my husband, I had to leave.
Now, their only communication with family in Syria is through text. They mostly talk about how to get them out.
They try, but it might take them 3-4 months walking through the desert, and it's very hot, and they might get dehydrated or even, in worst case, lost their lives.
3 years ago, Bassam's family easily crossed the border to Jordan in about a half hour, but that border is now closed. Bassam doubts his family will ever return.
There's no home, there's no future in Syria. No, not for our children or us, so it's destroyed.
The windy hummingbird.
In the living room, two kids play on the iPad. It's a hair salon game.
I cut hair.
You cut the hair?
Yeah.
The curling
iron. Ooh, let's try the curling iron.
I fumble around on the screen.
How do you do that? You drag it
10-year-old Aya just smiles and shows me how it works. I first met this family at the airport 7 months ago. They seemed overwhelmed, exhausted, but still smiling. They look far more at ease now. Bassam's wearing track pants and a t-shirt that says Good Times.
We came to America. We came to a whole new life, a whole different life. Everything is beautiful.
I tease Bassam that his phone keeps buzzing as we talk. He explains a new friend is inviting them for dinner, but mostly it's a group text with some news.
So I just found out that there's a new family that just arrived yesterday from Syria.
Here to Seattle.
Another family moved out of the war zone. Bassam hopes they'll meet soon. Refugee resettlement has become a hot-button issue in the presidential campaign. Since 2015, the U.S. has taken in about 5,400 Syrian refugees. About 100 have resettled in Washington state so far. Millions more are displaced or wait in refugee camps. UN officials have called it the humanitarian crisis of our time. In West Seattle, I'm Liz Jones, KUOW News.
This Saturday marks World Refugee Day, and Town Hall Seattle is hosting an event where refugees will share their stories on stage with KUOW reporter Liz Jones. We'll tweet out a link to that event right now at KUOW. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Speaking of records, don't you miss Ichiro? I know we have other reasons to be happy, but Ichiro used to be a Seattle Mariner. Yesterday, Ichiro Suzuki, who's now a Miami Marlin, did something nobody else has ever done. He got his 4,257th hit. But the major leagues won't recognize him as the record holder thanks to a dastardly villain. Mike, did I frame that in a grabby enough way?
Yeah, I guess for this Seattle audience, pander, pander.
This is sports and non-sports watcher, a host of the Slate podcast, The Gist, Mike Pesca. Will you explain the Major League hit leader is Pete Rose, who was banned from the game?
little feller named Pete Rose, who, you know, if we're talking about an empirical fact of who has the most hits in Major League Baseball history, then yeah, it's of course it's Pete Rose. Now, if you count the Japan League stats, and Japan's a good baseball league, you know, it's probably better than AAA baseball. If you count those stats, then Ichiro has equaled Pete Rose. But why should you count those stats? That's not how defining the Major League Hit King works.
Right.
That said, there's a case to be made that Ichiro is every bit the player that Pete Rose is.
Here's one reason to talk about it, even though you're right. It's not really a matter of discussion as far as the major league's concerned. But Pete Rose, as I said, banned from the game, said to USA Today, because Pete Rose is the hit king, he said, in Japan, they're trying to make me the hit queen. Is that why we care? This is another chance to irritate Pete Rose, who irritates us.
Yeah, though I think a lot of people like Pete Rose, you know, all those people who walk around wearing those red hats that say make Pete Rose great again.
Right.
But I think it's about personality. Ichiro, and this isn't a sports writer conceit of playing the game the right way. In fact, Pete Rose was the guy called Charlie Hustle and getting his uniform dirty, who played the guy the right way in the old crusty sports writer way of looking at it. Ichiro is just a fun, lovable, you know, forward-thinking guy in a lot of ways. To know him is to love him. Not so with Pete Rose. That said, compare the stats. I don't just mean this one stat of hits. Pete Rose was a bit better offensive player, I have to say.
Make that case.
Power, mostly due to power.
Oh, okay.
Ichiro is great at slapping the ball, and he's a fun, fun player to watch. Ichiro, you know, had more speed for sure. Ichiro has one of the best arms for a guy who's slight of build. I mean, an amazing arm in the outfield, so that was fun. And if you add defense to it, you can make the case that Ichiro might be the better all-around player, though Rose wasn't a bad defensive player by any stretch.
Yeah, but we're purely talking about greatest on-base hitter of all time, which in a global sense, this is what I want to ask you about. No, because nobody expects the major leagues to call him the major league hit leader, but doesn't that kind of emphasize how small time the major leagues are when we have Olympic and World Cups and a Pan American soccer tournament happening in Seattle? Then we have these quaint parochial leagues like Major League Baseball who don't know what happens in Japan.
Yes, and we play the World Series and only rarely, if ever, invite one team from Canada. But right, it's the best. Major League Baseball is the best, and players from all over the world want to play here. And Yu Darvish was dominating the Japanese leagues, and his goal as a pitcher was to come to Major League Baseball. Whereas on the other side, if a Major League player has washed out or doesn't think he could get enough money, then he goes to Japan and often dominates there. Major League Baseball, U.S. baseball, is better than Japanese baseball. Japanese baseball is the second best baseball league in the world, but it's the second best.
Ichiro Suzuki, 42 years old, still playing really well, by the way, hitting .336. And he is the hit leader, only kind of. And we've been talking about it with Mike Pesca of the Slate podcast, The Gist. Mike, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
It's KUW's The Record. And as I mentioned with Mike a moment ago, the eyes of the soccer world are on Seattle this week for the Copa America tournament. The teams are from South America and North and Central America and the Caribbean. On Tuesday, people crowded to CenturyLink Field to watch the number one national team, Argentina, take on Bolivia. Tonight, the U.S. men's team plays in Seattle in a quarterfinal match. Millions of people are expected to tune in, and that's just here in the United States. But KUOW reporter David Hyde says Seattle is also in the global spotlight over American soccer's problem with white privilege.
Seattleite Doug Andreasen loves soccer like you love ice cream. He's the former president of Washington Youth Soccer, and these days he chairs U.S. Soccer's Diversity Task Force. And that job has gotten him into some hot water this month with some U.S. soccer fans. He featured prominently in a Guardian article with the headline, "It's Only Working for the White Kids."
I have received a lot of email back from people, and I've received a lot of hate mail back from people as well. How dare you make this accusation? How dare you put this in headlines? And I say, let's talk about it.
Andreasen's job is to help clubs and players of all backgrounds become better integrated into U.S. soccer for two big reasons. One is to make the United States more competitive in the world's game. And the second goal is equity. But Andreasen says there's a lot of work to do, including here in Washington State.
We've had games where a Hispanic team has played a Caucasian team. where the referees have told us, the Spanish coach, you need to speak English. That's not in the handbook.
Andreasen's got a lot of stories like that, and he told me it's time for U.S. soccer to make some big changes.
In soccer, the top of the game is called the World Cup, and the United States men's team has not done very well in the World Cup. With a nation of 330-plus million people, you would think that at some point the United States should be able to win the World Cup. And what this change will be is will allow us to get players that have more creativity on the field that will ultimately make it to the men's and women's team, you know, to win the World Cup. We have the same issue in the women's game as we do the men's game, by the way. You look at the last – look at our world champions we have of members from Seattle, by the way. But look at the last picture when they won the World Cup. Does that picture represent America? I would say no.
Why is it so important that U.S. soccer looks like America?
America is diverse. And I think it's critical that we knock on the door of white privilege. And that's what we're talking about in our program as well, as white privilege.
Okay, so that's what you're hoping to change when it comes to the men's and women's U.S. national teams. But what about just the problem locally, especially here in Washington State? What are you seeing out there? What are the obstacles to that kind of change happening?
We started with a team that was in Tacoma, for example. They are called South Tacoma United. It was a team put together by a local coach, local community leader named Tony Enchez. He called me up and he said, I've got a team of 12 or 13 kids. We happen to be all Hispanic at this point in time. This was now 7 years ago. How do we play in Washington Youth Soccer's leagues? What do we have to do? And I said, well, you got to join a club. And he goes, what club do I have to join? And then the odyssey began, as I called it. So as that team began to go through the system and find a club to play for, they found they couldn't find a club to play for a lot of reasons. One, the clubs weren't very accepting of Hispanics in this case. They would give him information that would be all in English, and yet he had difficulty with English. He could certainly speak, but he had difficulty reading it. So whether he had league instructions or he had emails, that would come in English, and he said, can you give it to me in Spanish? Let's start there. And it became very, very difficult for this gentleman to get his one team together. Today, I'm proud to say, 7 years later, he's got about 26 teams, mostly Hispanic in his club now, that we've been able to assist and help through the system. So as I look at what I do for the underserved community, I always keep in mind this particular club that's down in Tacoma.
What are some of the other obstacles? There's the language challenges. What about money?
Absolutely. Money is probably one of the prime things. What we find many times, and we'll just talk about the Hispanics right this minute for the underserved population, because it's the largest population in the United States behind Caucasians. And many of these parents are immigrants to this country, and they're working one, two, sometimes three jobs, and they don't have the income to pay for club fees for their kids to play sports. Could be from $1,000 up to $5,000, depending on the size of the club and the elite level that they might play. That's just team fees, and that pays for coaches, by the way, is what it pays for. It doesn't pay for fields in many cases, so they have to go out and rent fields in addition to that. So there's additional fees for field rental, additional fees for referees. Referees don't referee for free. If the team travels any distance, whether it be from Tacoma to Seattle or Seattle to Spokane, you have travel fees involved with that, whether it be gas or lodging, whatever it might be. So it becomes a very wide block for these, a disparity for these kids to play soccer.
This is a barrier for kids playing not just in Washington State but all over the country. How do you turn that around at U.S. soccer?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. And many times, a lot of the fields that kids play on across this country are on school fields. So when we go to school districts, we find that there's a lower fee that they can pay for the field use, providing that they can demonstrate the fact that they're from the underprivileged community. And the referees as well. What we have said the referee communities, we said we also need some discounts for referees. And, you know, in the case of Hispanics, you can speak Spanish on the field. But it's not just Hispanics. We have a large Somalian community up in South Everett. They have the same problems that the Hispanics do. Just happens to be a different culture is what it happens to be. So what we're really talking about here is equity. We want social equity for soccer across the board.
That's Doug Andreasen. He's from Washington State, and he chairs U.S. Soccer's Diversity Task Force. The U.S. men's team plays tonight in Seattle at 6:30 p.m. in a quarterfinal match against Ecuador. They're hoping to get through to the semifinal, but nobody really expects them to win the Copa America tournament. Not this year, anyway. I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
You're listening to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Transgender and bathroom. Two words we've been hearing a lot lately in this national conversation about which bathrooms and locker rooms trans people should use. We're having that debate here in Washington. State Initiative 1515 would limit people's ability to use the bathroom that matches their gender identity. Opposing that initiative is Aiden Key, the founder of Gender Diversity. Aiden says this bathroom debate has turned a spotlight on transgender people, which might be a good thing in the long term, but in the short term, it also means he and other trans people are getting some awkward questions.
Very personal questions about my body and my experience and all of that. Who does what to whom in bed? You know, things that you would not ask a stranger. You would hopefully not ask anyone except maybe your close friends. And even that might be over a couple of drinks before you delve into that. So I asked myself, why do any of these people feel justified or entitled to ask these questions? What's underlying that? And that's where we start to touch upon some pretty layered and deep undercurrents.
What does underlie those questions to you?
It ties into a number of things. For example, I'm in my early 50s. So what kinds of images or representations or messages did I get about who transgender people were or are as I was growing up? Well, I got that from different movies. That might be the movie Psycho. So even though it's not about a transgender person, we see this man dressing as a woman, and we have that association with criminal, scary behavior. Silence of the Lambs is another story where the serial killer in the movie is trying to become a woman, and in a very horrific way. So you have all of that in the same bag of tricks as you meet a transgender person. So it's not a stretch to understand why someone might grab the hand of their young child to pull them away out of fear. Well, my child cannot be exposed to that. That person is not safe. Rather than looking at the fact that we're real people, we have families, we have children, we have spouses, we have jobs, we have lives.
Well, you just named a bunch of old movies.
Mm-hmm.
How do you reflect on where transgender visibility is in 2016?
Well, that's a pretty critical piece because the representations of transgender people are changing. I've done interviews quite a number of times in different forms of media. The questions before have always been, when did you know? And what about your genitals? Maybe not in so directive terms, but the inquisitiveness is so high. That's shifting. You know, we'll see whether you ask me about my genitals or not, but I'm kind of hoping we can, if we do talk about that, we talk about it in a more complex way. And I might be asking you, Bill, about yours at the same time,
right,
just to even it out.
Right.
But the questions and interest is getting deeper and more layered, more complex. And that is a good thing. The other thing is that the internet is allowing any of us, myself as an individual transgender person, or the families who are supporting their children in this journey, a platform to share that with a broader audience and in a more instantaneous way.
You've described this moment of visibility, though, as a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, the challenge is that the more engagement that you have with a transgender person or people, the more you know and understand about it, the more it's demystified and this is significantly less intimidating or scary. But those who are fearful can inspire and support the fear of anyone else around them. So we're seeing that even in Washington State as we have an initiative out there, I-1515, to repeal protections against discrimination for transgender people. Keep women and children safe. Please sign this petition, is their message. It's a scare tactic. It's a red herring. It's a diversionary way of scapegoating transgender people for a much bigger societal ill. This is gaining visibility so rapidly, and the ability to have forums where you can learn more or to have visible transgender people is really challenged. Number one, it's challenged because transgender people are in danger of serious either physical or sexual assault or murder. It's hugely prevalent in outrageous numbers. So the fear within our community and the ability to be visible takes a really courageous person. How does the rest of the world gain empathy for our journey, for our experience?
Aidan, someone listening who is curious, wants to understand transgender people and issues more, maybe for themselves, maybe on the behalf of children or some other group, what should they do?
They should get to know some transgender people.
What's the best way to do that?
That's a good question. Stop being resistant to it. I mean, ultimately, transgender people are all around, so find them.
You and I meet on the street. I don't know that you're transgender.
That's right. Well, and that's a misperception that most people have, is that they can tell who a transgender person is. But I have spent 2 decades now talking about my experience and talking about the work that I do. I talk about it to anyone who asks, wherever I go, because it really doesn't take long. I'm not putting it in anyone's face. Hi, my name's Joe. What's yours? Oh, hi, I'm Aidan. Oh, nice to meet you. Well, what do you do, Aidan? What kind of line of work are you in? And I take a deep breath because I know that what I'm saying might be startling to them. And I say, well, I run an organization that supports transgender children and their families. Pause. And
what do they usually say next?
They don't know what to say, so I've learned to keep talking.
So that person you've just met, and they ask you your line of work, mm-hmm. and if we get past that pause, you don't know how long the conversation is going to go. What do you want that person walking away with?
I want them to see that there's nothing to be afraid of, number one, and that's pretty easy because there is nothing to be afraid of. But I also want them to see someone who's experiencing joy in life and happiness and comes to them in an open-hearted and respectful way, because I believe that that inspires the same from someone else. And that I see as being a very, very effective approach.
So we're having, as you and I called it when we started this moment of visibility, of a spotlight on transgender issues. What do you see as the probable outcome and the ideal outcome? Where do you think this moment is headed?
The probable outcome is the same as any other social justice movement. You can chart it. It's the progression is happening. And that when there is greater awareness, greater visibility, more information, and more one-to-one connections, that distress and fear will dissipate. So I believe that that absolutely will happen. But I doubt that it will ever in my lifetime be this sort of utopia where being transgender is not an issue in some way. I expect to be navigating this in some way my entire life. But I do know from what's already happened in my 20 years of stepping into this world, I have seen significant progression that has matched the other civil rights movements of our time. And that provides me a lot of relief. And in the same way that the younger generations are a bit mystified at why the older generations still struggle with people of different races or people of differing sexual orientations, they will be equally mystified by why we are in such distress about this issue today.
Aidan Key with Gender Diversity, promoting education on gender issues for trans kids and families. We mentioned Washington State Initiative 1515 about who gets to use what public bathroom. The organizers of that are gathering signatures now toward a spot on the November ballot. We have invited the sponsors of Initiative 1515 to come on this show. We hope to bring that to you in the next couple of weeks. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. Hella Black, Hella Seattle is a new podcast, and it's a summer special, as in it started on Memorial Day and it's going until Labor Day. The women behind the podcast are Eula Scott Bino, Elena Caldwell, and Jasmine Jackson. First, they told me about that name, Hella Black, Hella Seattle.
We knew the show was going to be really local, and we are three women of color, and we wanted to be inclusive, but we also wanted to like really spell out who we were before people tuned in and got the wrong idea. And we are all hella black in hella Seattle.
What would the wrong idea be?
If they just heard Hella Seattle and they tuned in and it was not people of color, because it could have been, right? And so the nice thing about having it be Hella Black to start off with was it lets you know from the gate who we are in terms of like where our viewpoint's going to be coming from as people of color. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
In my listening, it's not like you guys are talking about being black all the time. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, you're talking about shrimp pho and,
yeah.
you know, folk life versus Sundayata or what just, you know,
yeah.
you're just talking. But there's a still a point of view, like you talk with the weed
yeah.
professionals, and it'll come up, you know, that, yeah, why is this a rich white thing? But
yeah.
But that's a small piece of it. Then you're just talking. I feel
right.
like maybe it's more your point of view affects who you're bringing to it.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Totally.
Well, black people don't often just sit around and talk about being black.
yeah.
And that's also a misconception, right? So, yes, we have well-rounded lives and yeah, so it's really the point of view of being hella black. I'm still hella black even if I talk about shrimp pho.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It doesn't make me less black because I eat different things than cornbread and chitlins.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, and we're hella yeah. Seattle, too.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's something that's really funny about the three of us is that, you know, if we go other places, when we go other places, people will stop and be like, you ain't from here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, we're from Seattle. Oh, I knew you were from, what? I didn't know you guys were up there. Because we are so Seattle. I mean, we are just as Seattle as every other person we meet on the streets.
What does that mean? How can they tell you're not from here?
That we are from Seattle?
Yeah.
I think because we are... Seattle people are very outspoken and very witty, I think. I think that I always joke that we're rained in most of the year.
Mm.
And so, like, rainy day recess is a real thing if you grew up here, when we grew up here. And so, during recess, your only option was to sit around and talk and hopefully talk good right? Like, so we know how to sit around and entertain ourselves.
Right.
And so I think all of that really translates into what makes us very Seattle. Also, we know nature in a way that most people don't.
Mm-hmm.
I tell this joke that my husband is from Boston and they would go to this like pond when they were in elementary school where they would fish. And, you know, the pond would be full of fish that they put there
Stocked.
Intentionally for the kids.
Yeah.
And I was like, but my elementary school, we went to the salmon hatchery and got salmon roe and took it back to school and watched it grow into be full salmon.
And also saw the salmon get killed, massacred.
I didn't
That's
see
like
that.
Oh my gosh. Are you for real?
No, at my we didn't go to the same elementary school.
Yeah. Insanity. Yeah. I don't even understand how they were allowing that. Literally, it was just like a tank full of fish, and they would pull a fish out
they'd
and just
slaughter it.
Yes.
I don't remember. Did you guys have roe too?
Bloodbath.
Did you guys get salmon
yeah.
roe?
Yeah. And then they took the roe, and we were supposed to be happy after seeing the tragedy.
I blocked that out. That's my life. I block out so
Good
many
for
things.
You.
But yeah, so that makes us Seattle, you know? I used to go on walks with my school to like Ravenna,
mm-hmm.
you know, like we are those things. We know this city mm-hmm. very well. And so we may be coming from a black perspective, but we've been living with you know, everybody else forever.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the numbers in Seattle. This isn't hella Atlanta, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what effect do you think that has on who you are, who your podcast is?
Yeah. Well, it's all we know.
Yeah.
So we've never been in a predominantly, more predominant than it is now, black city.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only like definition of we have as people of color in the city is what we have here. You know, the thing is, we are black people. All of our parents are black. All of our family right. is black. And we are from Seattle. So we've seen a large community our whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more spread out now, but it doesn't mean it's completely gone.
Right.
Are people of color losing an important concentration? You know, we all know about people are headed to Renton and Skyway. It should be hella Skyway. Hella Renton.
We ain't there yet.
Yeah.
No.
I think so. I mean, yeah, we've lost the concentration for damn sure. I tell the story about how growing up, I think this is true for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Our families did not live in the same houses before we were born, right? So they moved around the city. And where they moved was always in the central.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. So, like, our parents were like, I've lived in one house my whole life. Jasmine's lived in a few. Elena had one house probably your whole life, really, till this last year.
My whole life. Mm-hmm.
But before that, it wasn't like our parents were like, oh, this is it. They weren't born and raised there. They moved around the central district. That was it.
Yeah.
And
right.
so the nice thing about being younger in the city was, you, even if your best friend moved, they didn't move that far.
Right. Yeah.
And if you needed to get to a cousin's house, you probably were going to be able to walk.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Where now, and it's funny because I know Elena can relate to this too. I can walk past homes and think, I don't speak to these people. If I do speak to them in passing, we maybe just say hello and goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in your house, though. I've been in every crevice of your home. I probably had played hide and seek there. Mm-hmm. I probably know what your backyard is laid out like. I might have even hurt myself in your home. It's just interesting to be like, yeah, I've probably been in your house, but we don't have that community at all mm-hmm. anymore for me to have that connection with you. I'll never do it again. My kids won't do it. Probably.
Yeah. So you want that community. Does that inspire this podcast?
Yes, definitely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We are so lucky to have each other.
Yes, mm-hmm. we are.
And we know it. We have times where we think if it wasn't for the, you know, all three of us still being planted here, we don't know what we would do in terms of how we would enjoy ourselves or where we would go. We would make new friends, but it wouldn't be the same, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And when we hear people, we meet people all the time that are new to Seattle and don't know what to do mm-hmm. and are asking us for guidance. And for a very long time, I would hand out options,
yes. mm-hmm.
but it would never be enough to keep them, like, not to be good, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So now it's nice because it's like, oh, no, I have a real option. Mm-hmm. I got a text from someone the other day that was like, oh, I'm so excited for your podcast. I heard about it. Oh, I wish this was here 6 years ago, you know, because he's been a transplant for 6 years, lost.
Mm-hmm.
So, Yuli, you kind of led the way on the podcast, it sounds like.
Yeah.
You bothered them.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a degree in radio broadcasting, and I did not know what to do with it after I graduated because it's a very hard field to get into. I always joke that if Diane Remain quitting, ain't no openings, right?
Right.
And and so.
Well, you're in luck.
What?
She's leaving.
What?
Yeah, pretty soon.
Well, maybe then. Yeah. with her richity voice and just sticking on. So I took a long time just trying to figure out where to plant myself and was really trying to think of ideas for a podcast for a while because I knew I wanted to do one, but I also know that like the forefront of my entire existence is wanting to make Seattle a better place for people of color. It's just all of our legacies are here. Everything our parents have done has been mm-hmm. impacted in Seattle, and like we want to do the same kind of thing. And so I sat long and hard on my honeymoon thinking about how to make it right and came up with this whole entire thing in the sense of like, oh, I know what Elena could do and oh, I know what Jasmine could do and I know it would work out great if we had interviews and we had to figure it all out. The only thing I didn't have was a name. And so I don't know. We came up with the name, all three of us, or did I come up with it?
I think you came
up
with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to do like Young, Gifted, and Black for Hella. And Marvin was like, no. My husband was like, that's not it. And I was like, I know, because I'm not that young anymore. And he was like, also, it's not that. Cool. Like, it's not that.
I mean, it's...
No, it is.
It's not catchy.
So how did you sell Jazz and Elena on it?
It's funny because I had this huge buildup where I was like, they're not going to do it. Only because we all have like really busy lives already. Mm-hmm. And we spend a lot of time together already. And so it's unique to say, hey, want to spend even more time with the people that you spend probably every weekend with. So now you're giving me Mondays mm-hmm. too. I was saying, I picked Jasmine up this morning. I was like, I haven't seen you in over a week. It's been forever.
A week.
Yes. So I was fearful of it. And so I sat them down and I pitched it and I had built myself up and talked my way into it. And their reaction was like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
It was pretty simple.
And I cried because I was really happy.
You also found a way to kind of capitalize on what we were really good at and what we were already bringing to the table in terms of our friendship.
Yeah,
you know?
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Like, Eula's a talker.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We always go to Elena for food reviews.
I'm just obsessed with food.
References.
So it made sense. And it was either this or actually do a blog because they've been bothering me about that for forever. So like, I'd rather just talk about some food than write up a whole thing.
Yeah.
It's too much.
And Jasmine knows everything that's going on the weekends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm always like, let's go to this exhibit or let's go to this party or mm-hmm. I'm going to this festival.
Jasmine's like literally like subscribed to every single like feed in the entire city.
Yeah.
Like if the Sam is having something, it's in her inbox. Mm-hmm. If Fry is doing something, it's in her inbox. If there's a party going on, it's in her inbox. So she always knows what's going on anyways.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So why you're all busy. You're all working.
Yeah.
Why is this worth your extra time? What's the ultimate satisfaction?
I think, first of all, I'm already going to be looking up Yelp reviews and going to new food places. So why not share that with other people, right? But then also, I think I was like really surprised about how many people are into it.
Yes.
And I think that drives me a lot. Like this, just the response and people like loving it and being really excited for it. It makes me even more excited. So it's like this thing that we get to feed each other on, you know?
Mm-hmm. And we listen to podcasts, like we listen to The Read, which we really enjoy, yeah. which is a great podcast with people of color. Mm-hmm. But I think the big divide there is that everything that they experience or talk about is from a New York perspective. Mm-hmm. They live in New York. One of the main characters, main cast members, is from Miami. The other's from Oklahoma. Those are not our stories. Right. Mm-hmm. And so when they talk about things or they share their hardships, we're like, all right, cool, but I ain't with it. Mm-hmm. And so it's really nice to have that opposite end of it being so local. I mean, you can find us. People yeah. who are like, oh, I hope I get to run into you someday. Yes. We're like, yeah, we'll be at this fantastic event on Saturday, mm-hmm. the Station Block Party. We'll have a table from 12 to 8. You mm-hmm. can come by and say hi.
Come yeah. hang with us. Build yeah. with us.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
That is Eula Scott-Bino, Elena Caldwell, and Jasmine Jackson. You can find their podcast, Hella Black, Hella Seattle, wherever you get your podcasts. Now, if in person is more your style, the Station Block Party they mentioned, that is this Saturday on Beacon Hill. We're going to tweet a link to Hella Black, Hella Seattle right now. Join us at KUOW. Thanks for tuning in to The Record today. I'm Bill Radke. Here at KUOW, we've gotten a number of phone messages from people reacting to the shooting at the gay nightclub Pulse in Orlando this weekend.
Hi, it's Anthony from Seattle, and as I think about the tragedy in Orlando, I think how easily that could be me or the members of my community here, and I worry that we as humans can never find a way to all get along.
We heard from Ann Lazaroff, a therapist in Seattle. She turned on the TV Sunday morning, as she normally does.
I saw right immediately that there'd been another mass shooting. And then I realized, oh, my God, it was at a gay nightclub in Orlando. And my heart just sank. I mean, I just felt this heaviness throughout my body. And waves of fear came over me and deep grief.
Lazaroff had an urge to jump on an airplane to Orlando to help people with their grief. She knew that wouldn't be possible.
So I thought, well, wait a minute. There are plenty of LGBTQ people here. Right here in Seattle, that are going to be having just as hard a time with it as I am.
So, Ann Lazaroff put out a call on her Facebook page saying LGBTQ people of color and Muslims who are struggling after the Orlando attack could come to her for some free counseling, and a handful of people have taken her up on that.
Just to see the pain and the anguish and the fear in their eyes, and to know how awful this is. And to be able to ease that a little bit, and I know it's not much, but I know it helps. Sometimes people need a professional to help them through that kind of grief and that kind of terror.
We're tweeting out a link now for how to contact Anne. And if you're doing something to help process your own grief over this mass shooting, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at record.org with your stories and ideas. Again, tweeting out a link to that therapy help at KUOW. I leave you with a bit of news, which is that the creator and star of Hamilton is leaving the show. You know the Broadway monster hit musical Hamilton? Lin-Manuel Miranda's been in that show since it first appeared off-Broadway last year. His final show is July 9th, though he says he'll return to Hamilton again and again. Meanwhile, Miranda will be busy. He is starring opposite Emily Blunt in a movie sequel of Mary Poppins. Thanks for tuning in to The Record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information.